Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. By now you know what the show's about. It's about honoring our veterans for their service, for their selfless sacrifice. It's about preserving their stories, those unique firsthand perspectives on history, before it's too late to do so. And hopefully, along the way, the rest of us will be inspired to be all that we can be and use that freedom that our servicemen and women have secured for us in a positive and productive way. Next week, this show is going to be coming to you live from KMJ's Lifestyle Expo at the Radisson Conference Center in downtown Fresno. For a list of seminars, you can go to kmjnow.com. The two seminars that I'm hosting will be Preserving Family History at 9:30 and also Becoming an Author at 10:45 in the morning next Saturday. I'm looking forward to it. Should be a lot of fun. And boy, did we have fun. Boy, were we moved last week at Warner's Theater. Big thanks to all who came out for the 65th anniversary of the end of World War II and a terrific tribute to the Greatest Generation as we dedicated that afternoon to keeping the spirit of 45 alive. We started the show with the Sounds of Freedom Band providing the soundtrack as all the World War II veterans in attendance were honored branch by branch. That is always moving and was very special. I was also very impressed by Jeremy Elvis Pierce in a performance that really did fit the occasion. Congressman Jim Costa showed up. He shared very sincerely, I thought, about not taking our veterans for granted. Appreciate his support of the Greatest Generation. He's worked very hard to get a lot of medals for veterans who had never received them. And what could I say about the Sons of the San Joaquin? World-class talent, homegrown right here in Central California. And to have Jack and Joe and Lon Hanna close that show last week, leading the whole theater in God Bless America, that was a moving experience. If you missed out, I hope that you'll plan on making it next year, and I'll make sure that we let you know about it when it's approaching. I also want to extend kudos and thanks to Bill Dietzel, the publisher of Veterans Magazine. He's such a tireless advocate for veterans, and he invested really so much of his own time, energy, his own money into that event to make sure that we will never forget. So I know this is an unusually long intro. I normally get right down to firing questions at my guests, but before we do that today, I do want to share something. I found myself getting emotional at the strangest moment in our Spirit of 45 event last Saturday. The California Ground Pounders were on stage in red, white, and blue showing off their clogging and square dancing, and I couldn't help but think of old Don Hoff. That's what he liked to call himself, and I know that that would have been one of his favorite moments in the show because he and his beautiful bride Elsie spent the last 30 years square dance calling. I have been interviewing a veteran a week for more than 5 years now. I've seen quite a few of them move on, but in some cases, I've really been blessed to develop ongoing friendships. And anybody who knew Don Hoff knows what a wonderful friend that Don was. Don was a radio man and gunner in an SBD dive bomber. You've heard his story on this show if you're a longtime listener. He was on the USS Enterprise on December 7th, 1941. And not too long after that, he participated in those monumental moments at Midway. He was a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross, and he was so proud of the men that he served with that he would tell their stories to anyone who would listen, whether it was the History Channel, which he did several times, the World War II Museum in New Orleans, or just some guy with a little show on the weekends in his hometown. That would be me. Don was as adept at email as any octogenarian that I've come across, and he had warned all of us on his address list that he'd be off the grid for a few weeks while he underwent surgery. Don really had survived more than his fair share of harrowing moments in the skies over the Pacific. He'd made it through a long career with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department, and he'd even beaten prostate cancer. But Don did not make it out of that heart surgery. He had somewhere else to go. I know he has crystal clear reception today. He was remembered oh so fondly at services this morning in Easton, and I wanted to take a moment to remember him here today, especially since the veteran that you'll hear from this afternoon is one Don told me I ought to talk to. David Fusinato was a 19-year-old Marine when he stepped foot on Okinawa on April Fool's Day in 1945. Now he's a volunteer docent at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, and he's going to tell us all about Okinawa. You probably know that was the last major land battle of the Pacific War. You might also know, in terms of sheer numbers, it was the bloodiest. Over 12,000 Americans were killed, 50,000 more wounded, in a battle that lasted 82 days. You certainly wouldn't have gotten that picture if you went to the movies in April of 1945 and you heard Ed Herlihy's voice on this Universal newsreel.
The Admiral of the Fleet's five stars flying above the Pacific Naval Headquarters at Guam are ready to follow Admiral Nimitz, left, about to set out for the conquest of Okinawa. 1,400 ships get underway, and the invasion forces aboard cast worry aside for the moment and beat a tune out on the old squeeze box while Ernie Pyle, left, watches a fast-stepping jitterbug run up a little hot rug cutting for the biggest invasion fleet ever assembled in the Pacific. Strategic airfields are the objectives as the great fleet's guns open up. Terrific rocket barrages level shore defenses. Army, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marine cameramen combine to photograph these stirring scenes of the landing nearest to Japan's main island. Kyushu is only 360-odd miles away. Little resistance was encountered by the first troops ashore, but sporadic sniper fire was met. Pillboxes cleaned out with grenades. Enemy defense grew stronger near Naha, the capital. Forts similar to this met our troops. Thousands of civilians willingly gave up to the Yanks. Miserable and undernourished, they at first wondered at the treatment they would receive from the Yanks, but fear soon vanished. With the latest defeat of the Jap fleet and Air Force, Okinawa's fate is sealed.
That newsreel went out April 9th, 1945. The reality was that bloody battle was far from over. It wouldn't wind down until the middle of June. If you'd like to watch that entire newsreel report from 65 years ago, I have it on my blog at kmjnow.com. And we'll hear from a Marine who was there, David Fusinato, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remember, next week, this show will be coming to you live from KMJ's Lifestyle Expo at the Radisson Conference Center in downtown Fresno. I'll have a couple seminars there that morning, first on preserving family history at 9:30. That was a big hit last year. And right after it at 10:45, we'll have a seminar on becoming an author. And I'm not the only quote-unquote author who will be talking to you. A couple other folks who have written a lot more books than I have will be there to add their insight. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of you out there next week at the KMJ Lifestyle Expo and having Hometown Heroes come to you live from that expo next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Today is another day where we say Semper Fi, another Semper Fi guy, a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, David Fusinato of Fresno, California, my guest today. He'll be 85 just after Christmas. He was a lot younger than that. On December 7th, 1941, that date I ask every guest about on this program, because everybody seems to remember something. You were in Morgan Hill, California, December 7th, 1941. How did you hear of those life-changing events, and what was the first you heard of the attack on Pearl Harbor?
It was Sunday afternoon, 7th of December, and we heard it on the radio. We never, not too many of us knew where Pearl Harbor was, really. Eventually we found out all about it, so.
And here you are, just about to turn 16. You're probably excited for your 16th birthday coming up, and all of a sudden things are changing. Did you realize then that that might change your life, America being at war?
Not exactly, no. No, I was just too young and innocent to believe that.
How long was it before the U.S. Marine Corps got a hold of you and made a man out of you?
It was a couple of years later that I enlisted in the Marine Corps.
And why did you make that decision? A lot of guys would say, hey, I'm going to enlist in the Air Corps or the Navy. I don't want to be on the ground fighting anybody. But you were one of those that said, I want to be a Marine. Why did you do that?
Well, I was thinking about going in the Navy because all my friends, close friends, were joining the Navy. And last week or so before I enlisted, I don't know, something told me, don't go in the Navy, it's cold up there in Farragut, Idaho, where their the boot camp is, and go in the Marine Corps. So I ended up in the Marine Corps.
Did you ever come to a day in the weeks and months that followed that you questioned that decision and said, "Oh, it's a little tougher than I expected"?
Not at all. Not at all. I was just happy to be in the Marine Corps. If I was going to go into service, I was happy to be there.
And I imagine by that time, since you were young, you weren't old enough to go in the service when the war started. The war had been going for a couple of years. You'd probably heard some stories by that time about what some of the Marines were doing. What impressed you about what you heard about the Marine Corps?
Well, I don't know. They're gung-ho. I don't know. I don't have the word for it.
But there was something about their bravado that attracted you.
Yes, exactly.
How tough was your training? Did it whip you into shape pretty fast, or did you feel like you were already prepared?
Very fast. Boot camp was very fast the latter part of the war, because they just get you in and out and put you on a ship and send you overseas because they needed replacements over there for all the Pacific battles they were fighting. And I was fortunate. After boot camp, I was sent to tank training school in San Diego. I spent 6 weeks there learning all the operation of tanks from driver to the guns. We fired all the big guns and all the weapons that associated with tanks. A lot of driver training, a lot of artillery range training till we finished tank school. When we came out of tank school, we knew every operation of that tank. As I remember, we got a short leave, and I came home to Morgan Hill from San Diego, and I told him I'd probably be the last time I'd be home for a while, because I was due for shipment overseas. So I got back to San Diego, and they transferred us to Pendleton in a replacement group, and from there we went overseas. I joined the 1st Marine Division in the Russell Islands, 1944.
What was going through your mind as you were on that ship heading over to an atmosphere that I'm sure you had seen pictures of, you had heard about, but you had never really experienced?
Well, not really. I was so young at the time that I'd never realized what the hell I was getting into.
And that was probably a good thing, right?
Yeah, it was a darn good thing.
You talked about joining the 1st Marine Division. Now, I'm sure in the years since, you've read a lot about that division, but probably even then you realized that some of the guys, as long as they were surviving what they'd been through during that war, some of those guys had been in the Marine Corps for a long time. They're the old breed and guys you could probably learn a lot from. Was that the case? Did you have guys that took you under their wing?
Well, during tank school, all the trainers were all Guadalcanal veterans, 1st Marine Division. And when I went overseas, there was a lot of them on the ship with me going back overseas for another combat tour.
Were you able to draw from their experience to kind of prepare yourself?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, they used to tell stories, to us about combat, Guadalcanal, and their tank operations on the canal.
Did you ever think their stories were a little exaggerated?
Sometimes. You extend to exaggerate a little bit.
Probably your perspective changed a little bit once you actually experienced it for yourself.
Exactly.
When you joined them in the Russell Islands in late 1944, what was that atmosphere like? Because now we know that the war had less than a year left, but then nobody knew anything. You had no idea how long it was going to take.
Exactly.
What was it like for you, and what kind of things were going through your mind?
We started combat training immediately, because this was December, and we got ready to board ship in March of 45 for the operation of Okinawa. So we had just a couple of months to prepare us for combat. Being I was a new boot, I had a lot to learn.
Now, you're not even 20 years old yet, and you're getting ready for Okinawa. Did you have any idea what you're in for, what you'd be up against? Did you look at other battles in the Pacific and think it was going to be like that?
Yeah, I've watched, mostly movies about the war in the Pacific. I never saw any actual combat film. But, I wasn't looking forward to it because it was a new experience for me, but I was thinking about it, but nothing compared to what I thought when we went into combat, so. So all different situation.
Tell us about that. What was it like when you went from a guy who's been building toward this, know it's going to happen, and then you're actually there being fired at, doing some firing in the thick of it? What kind of walk us through the Okinawa situation?
The 1st Marine Division landed on Okinawa April 1st, April Fool's Day, 1945, and we had the area we were supposed to occupy included Kadena Airfield and Yantan Airfield, and they're just adjacent to one another. No resistance. We went across the island, halfway across the island the first day, occupied our area of both airfields. I was set up for bivouac and overnight, and what we were going to do the next day, we were just going to advance a little further across the island, across the narrowest part of the island, actually. And that night we suffered some bombardment from, they had big guns in the hills, just maybe 12, 15 miles away from the airports, and they shelled the airfields, runways, tore them up pretty bad the first night. But that was the first time we were under fire after we landed on the island. First night was kind of rough, and that's the first time any of us had experienced a lot of bombardment. I guess everybody was scared. I know I was.
And did it kind of...
If you don't say you're scared while you're lying.
Did it kind of suck you guys in that you were able to advance so quickly when you landed that there was no opposition to the actual landing?
We couldn't figure it out. We figured we were being in a trap. And they were just waiting for us to get on the island, and they were going to cut loose on us, bonsai and all that. Whatever you hear, you know, through the scuttlebutt, but nothing happened. And so we were on the island about 25 days before we even got into combat. And during those 25 days, we used to bring in supplies with Amtraks and trucks into our division area and our battalion area, and then we started combat training. They had to keep us busy doing something because you're just standing around there. So they put us in combat training all over again. We cleaned all the guns over and over every day, cleaned the guns just to keep us busy, keep our mind off of what was coming, which we didn't know what was coming.
But you did know that they were shelling you at nighttime?
Oh, no, they stopped the shelling, then the kamikaze came in, and we could watch the anti-aircraft display every night. The kamikaze would come in, and during the day too, and we from the island we could see the whole harbor, and ships being hit by suicide airplanes and carriers, and it was devastating.
And I imagine kind of a helpless feeling, too, that you guys are there. There's plenty of you, but you're just sitting around. Hurry up and wait, I guess, huh?
Exactly, yeah. So around the, it was about the 25th, 26th of April, the 1st Marine Division was called up to the front lines to relieve an Army division. I believe it was the 27th Army Division. Took all our equipment and camp and everything and moved up to the near the front lines, which was the Shuri line on Okinawa. And the next day we were in the front lines operating our tanks with the artillery and the infantry. I believe it was the 1st Marines or the 5th Marines Regiment.
So what were your duties with the tank?
Well, I started out as a loader in the tank. That's loading the 75-millimeter gun. I was also, the loader's also the radio man. I probably spent the time loading maybe a couple of weeks or so, and one of the gunners in another tank in my company got wounded, and so I took his place as gunner. So I had a little experience in shooting the gun in combat, the big gun.
when you finally were on the front lines, that first day of actually seeing what was going on and experiencing it firsthand and not just standing, what was that like for you? What was the biggest impression that it made on you?
Well, you were so busy inside the tanks that you hardly had time to think about what was going on the outside. But we did see a lot of Marines that were wounded. We could see them through the periscope in the tanks. And they would operate with us, and we'd kind of operate with them. And we would sometimes it was protection for them, because they'd, stay close to the tank, and so they could, they wouldn't be hit by small arms fire or anything, and they would direct our targets a lot of times, too. They had an intercom, had a phone on the outside of the tank where the infantry could keep in contact with the tank commander.
Well, I think this is probably another good spot to catch a break here. David Fusinato, Marine Corps veteran of World War II, is our guest today. We'll be back with the rest of his story. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, joined this week by a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, David Fusinato. He'll be 85 years old this December, but he wasn't quite 20 when he was on the island of Okinawa toward the end of World War II. It's a battle you may have heard of, but don't know that many specifics about. You probably hear a lot about Iwo Jima, but after that, the bloody Battle of Okinawa was the last major battle of World War II. David was there in the thick of it. We heard just a little taste of what he was doing inside that tank. And you talked about initially being a loader, loading that 75-millimeter gun, which I'm sure helps with your upper body strength, but also having to work the radio. How much communication is going on in a situation like this where you're inside a tank firing at the enemy and trying to avoid his fire?
Communication mostly is with other tanks in the battalion or the company, where they're located, of course, it's all code. Most of it is code, I should say.
It seems to me like a lot to worry about. If you're just trying to stay alive and do your job and you got to keep a gun loaded, then you got to talk to people, too, and the rest of those guys in the tank.
Yeah, once you set the radio, it's pretty well to takes care of itself. It's not too difficult.
Sounds like you handled it just fine. And then they made you a gunner when another gunner was wounded. And, you know, it struck me when you said that. How secure did you feel inside this tank? Did you feel more secure knowing that you had that armor around you, or less secure knowing that as a tank you're a bigger target?
Yeah, I felt pretty secure till we took a hit on top of the turret. And it jarred everybody in the tank, but fortunately nobody was really seriously wounded or... We got a lot of bruises and stuff, but outside of that, well, everybody was okay.
Is that something you have any kind of warning of? Do you see?
We think it was a mortar hit the top of the tank.
What did it feel like?
It jarred everybody inside the tank. And
did you leave your feet?
No, I was because if I left my feet, I would bump my head on the inside top of the turret.
But it gave you a little shaking.
Oh, yes. Shook everybody up.
Was that the only time you got hit?
That's the only time we got hit by anything big. We took a lot of small arms fire. Any tank weapons didn't hit our tank in particular, but the tanks around us got hit by any aircraft. I mean, any tank weapons. And the Japanese had a good one, too, a 47-millimeter.
What did you see happen to those tanks that got hit by that?
Well, most of them survived. It took a hit in the side and it penetrated the tank, but it didn't do any damage on the inside of the tank. One of them had the tracks knocked off of it by an explosive, but the crew got out and got back to the front line, so they were okay. One of our platoon tanks, platoon I was in, they got hit one time, and I believe the gunner was killed, and the driver was seriously wounded. That was out of our company. Now, the other companies, I really don't know. I really can't say anything about them.
So you knew, though, what could possibly happen to you guys. That was always out there.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah.
Now, when you were the loader and handling the radio, how much visual contact did you have outside the tank? Did you have any idea where you were going, or are you pretty much blind?
Because every hatch had a periscope, and you could see exactly where you were going, and you can turn the periscope around with 360 degrees, so you can see pretty much where you are in the area and any enemy coming towards you, As a gunner, you have a telescopic sight.
That was my question. Once you became a gunner, did that kind of give you a different view of the whole war?
A very, very different view. Yeah, you had your telescopic sight, plus you had your, which you could see all over. I mean, close up. But that was a lot different than being a loader, I tell you.
I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of some of our audience members, and there are probably a lot of people that haven't heard us talk too much about tanks before. But in your tank group on Okinawa, the tanks that you're in, how many men to a crew? How many guys are inside that tank?
A 5-man crew.
And so you at first were the loader, then you end up the gunner. And are you making the decision to fire that gun, or is someone making it for you?
No, tank commander is making the decisions. Where to point the gun and when to fire.
There's not a lot of you having to react necessarily to what you see. You just have to hear the command.
Yeah, but once I pick out a target with the telescopic sight, I can tell the tank commander through the intercom radio I have a target in sight, and then he'll look at it with it maybe his binoculars or through the periscope or something, and then say fire away.
So communication really was key.
Yes.
And what kind of targets are you firing upon?
Caves mostly. And if we can find an open cave, then we open fire on it. And sometimes you can't see anything at all along the ridges. And and a lot of times the infantry alongside of us picks out a target. They phone the tank commander, and the tank commander gives a message to the gunner just about exactly where's that. I forgot to tell you, alongside the big gun, there's a 30 caliber that's coaxed to the big gun. And you fire the 30 caliber, and it's got tracers, every third bullet, fourth bullet. And so you can pick out the target exactly. And the tank commander says, yeah, you're right on it, so fire away. So then you fire the small gun first, pick out your target, and then fire the big gun.
Was it any different doing that in actual combat than it had been in training?
Yeah, a lot different. Yes, very different.
Was it harder?
Yes, it was. Yeah, during training, while you're rolling along, and they fire at that dummy tank out there, and so you fire away and hope you hit it. But in combat, no, it's a lot different. Yeah, no comparison.
And as far as how your days went, you talked about waiting nearly a month to actually get in the action while you're in reserve there on the island. Now once you're actually in action, how long did that go? Did you go in spurts of 10, 15 minutes at a time? Did you feel like it was the whole day through going nonstop? What was that like for you as far as how intense and how engaged you were?
When you go in the front lines, it's all day, from daylight till dark. We couldn't keep our tanks on the front lines after dark. We'd have to pull back to the tank area, refueling, re-ammo, get ready for the next day. Clean the guns, get ready for the next day action. So every night we pull off the lines, leave the infantry out there all by themselves. I really felt sorry for them, but nothing we could do. And that's the way we operated.
How exhausting was that to be on and have the pressure on and be really fighting for your life from daybreak till sunset?
Well, I don't know. I guess you kind of get immune to it, kind of numb. We set up machine gun nests all around the perimeter of the tank park and stand guard most of the night. 4 or 5 hours anyway. And luckily, you get 3 or 4 hours sleep before you had to get up and go back into the front lines again.
Is it fair to say that that could be more agonizing than what you're doing during the day? Because you can't see anything? You don't know when something's going to happen?
Yeah, it's just pretty scary at night there, when, especially when they send the flares up and the flares come down and you see all these shadows out there in the distance. And you don't know if people, the enemy is moving out there towards you, or if it's just shadows from the flare coming down and you know, moving tree branches and trees. And so it's pretty scary at night.
Was there anything that kind of kept you going, kept you focused, kept you determined to make it through another day? Because this, I mean, it seems like when you do this day after day, it could really drain you and kind of wear on you.
I don't know. I guess we did the best we could. No, we had to do it, and we had a job to do, and somehow we got through a day today.
Did you ever have guys with you that you kind of had to give a pep talk to, or vice versa?
You mean, we had guys that we called it Asiatic, like battle fatigue. We had a couple guys that kind of broke down, sure.
And I imagine that doesn't make things any easier for you.
No. You think about that, you know. It's on your mind constantly, but we just had to keep going, that's all.
I imagine there had to be some times there where it felt like it was never going to end. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. A very serious situation, a very, what would they say, devastating combat is something you can't explain. It's just unbelievable.
I know when you're in the middle of it, it's very difficult to see the big picture and have a grasp of what's happening around you. But did it get to a point where you started to see signs of victory on its way, of the battle nearing its end?
With the Battle of Okinawa, once we took the Shuri line, the Japanese moved as far south as they could. They were near the southern tip of the island. And so we knew that, you know, it was just a matter of time where we'd win the battle, or I should say secure the island, exactly, yes.
In all those days of combat and staring through that periscope and firing away and seeing everything that was happening around you, are there any things that you saw or witnessed that really stand out that left the biggest impression on you?
Yeah, one day was pretty scary. We had three tanks in a column, and we were headed to the front lines, and we were warned about suicide soldiers, Japanese soldiers. They would carry what we call satchel charges, and they would hide alongside of the road in their spider holes or whatever. And as a tank came along, they would run out and throw the satchel charge in the tracks of the tank. Well, the satchel charge would explode, blow the tracks off the tank. And one day we were going up to the front lines, and I saw one of those little buggers come off the side of the road there, and he had a satchel charge in his hand, and then he threw it at the tank. Luckily, it bounced off the tank, the side of the tank, and in the meantime, our middle tank shot him. And so that was a pretty scary moment. We were waiting for the big explosion.
And he threw it at your tank or a tank in front of you?
No, it was the middle tank. The middle tank took the hit. But luckily, it bounced off the tank. So, but that was probably the worst that I actually saw, you know.
Well, and I'm sure you heard about a lot more than that, and we're going to find out some more of that from David Fusinato when we come back. This is Hometown Heroes on Newstalk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on Newstalk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've been talking about Okinawa, bloody battle at the end of World War II, one experienced by our guest today, David Fusinato, a Marine Corps veteran of World War II. You heard him talk about his duties with the 1st Tank Battalion, part of the 1st Marine Division on that island of Okinawa, some of the things that he witnessed and experienced, and we'll talk more about that now. You talked about the battle winding down and getting close to the end of that, but even when that battle was over your duties weren't done. A lot would still follow that. Was there any kind of celebration among the troops when you realized that the island was secure, that the Japanese, who were willing to fight to the death, had really, for all intents and purposes, been defeated on Okinawa?
No, there was no celebration, no.
And why wasn't there? Was it because you knew there was still more to come?
Exactly, yes. We weren't finished yet.
And what did you still have to do, or what did you think you still had to do?
Well, at that time, we didn't know. We knew probably the invasion of Japan would be coming up next, and but we didn't know too much about that either until we set up camp and started training for the invasion of Japan.
Now, one thing I didn't ask you about with regard to the actual battle on Okinawa, and this was the first battle that you were involved in, so it was the only real taste of this you had. Did the sheer volume of casualties ever get to you? I mean, was that ever something that became an intimidating or imposing thought in your mind to see how many of your fellow Marines were dying there?
We knew we suffered heavy casualties, but we never knew the figures until later on, actually till after the war, after VJ Day. And then we realized, you know, how devastating that battle was.
So it was probably a good thing you didn't know the numbers at the time.
Exactly.
So the battle is complete. The island is secure. But you guys aren't leaving the island. You just moved a little bit.
Moved up to the north end of the island, set up a new camp, and started training for the invasion of Japan, which was taking place in the fall of 45.
And none of you have ever heard of an atomic bomb. There's no reason to think that that invasion won't happen.
Exactly. The atomic bomb was all new to us.
What kinds of things had you heard about what to expect on mainland Japan? Did you have any reason to believe it would be any different than what you'd experienced there?
Worse.
Why was it going to be worse?
Well, I believe all the Japanese civilians were armed and ready for us. And besides that, the Japanese had a lot of weapons left, a lot of suicide weapons left, like suicide submarines. Of course, they had the kamikaze airplanes. They must have had hundreds of those stowed away somewhere. Any method at all where they could kill a lot of Americans by that.
I'm sure you've heard the estimates, the official government military estimates at the time were that an invasion of mainland Japan would cost at the least 1 million American lives, not to mention what would happen on the Japanese side and who knew how long this would go on. Is there much doubt in your mind that you would have been part of that 1 million, that your name would have been on that list had the bomb not been dropped?
I believe that the bomb saved my life, just like it did thousands of Pacific veterans. Yeah, I really do believe, and I thank old Harry Truman and everybody that was responsible for dropping a bomb.
When did you hear about it, and what was the buzz around where you were?
We heard about the first bomb, I guess it was the next day in the morning in the mess hall. It was announced.
Do you remember how that announcement came out?
Everybody was green. They didn't know anything about atomic energy. Very few. The college guys knew something about it. But
Well, I'm just curious, because this has to be something none of you guys have ever heard of before. And I'm curious, you know, how everybody reacted to that news. Was there instant celebration? Was there confusion?
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion, because nobody knew anything about the bomb, about atomic energy. We learned in a hurry all about it and how devastating that bomb was. And then, of course, when they dropped the second one, well, we figured it was just a matter of time till the Japanese finally surrendered.
Do you remember about where you were when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered and what that meant to you and the guys who were around you?
Oh, we were combat training to hit the island of Japan. It was great. I think they gave us 2 beers that day. Can't remember, but I think it was like a couple of beers to celebrate.
Well, depending on how fuzzy your memory is, that might tell us how many beers were given. You know, a lot of people have memories of VJ Day, and you've seen the pictures of Times Square and celebrations all across the United States. Mm-hmm. But you and the guys you were with had a very different perspective on it. I mean, this really did save your life, so I imagine you celebrated as much as anybody.
And most of the guys, well, not most of the guys, but the guys that had enough points to go home shortly after that, they were aboard ship and going back to the States. I didn't have enough points to go home, so I ended up in North China after the war as occupation.
And I imagine that gave you quite a bit of perspective, too. What kinds of things did you see there?
It was great. It was great to be stationed in North China after the islands. You know, there was a lot of new people joining the division, tank battalion, and we had to train them to just in case something revolted, we'd have to use our tanks again.
For the people listening who weren't alive back in August of 1945 and don't have a memory of what it meant for the war to be over, for someone who, you know, for a good chunk of your life, from the time you're a teenager to now being almost out of your teens, this was your way of life, something that you had known. To realize that the war was finally over, that victory against all these odds had been won, how big of a deal was that to you? Did it kind of change your whole outlook of your life? Was there a big sense of relief, or because you're only 19 years old, was it no big deal?
A big sense of relief.
What, had you been at a point before that where you didn't think you could plan on too much of a future, but now you had a future? Is that fair to say?
Yes, I guess you could say that, yeah.
And you talked about having to go to North China and occupation forces. Eventually, you did get to come home. What was that like for you? And do you remember what it felt like to see your family again after probably a lot of nights where you didn't think you'd ever see them again?
Well, it was great. Yeah. Kind of, you know, strange in a way, but it was great to be back home.
Is that something? I've talked to a lot of veterans who can still describe that kind of experience, you know, with feeling like it was yesterday. Can you still see the look on your mother's face?
More or less, yeah. After all those years, yeah. Everybody, my sister was thrilled to death to see me home. And, yeah, my mother, dad, all my neighbors. Yeah, it's just a big deal.
You know, there are a lot of guys coming home from war now in Iraq or Afghanistan who have a lot to deal with as they get on with their lives. Is that something that was difficult for you to kind of work yourself back into civilian life after everything you had experienced and seen overseas?
Yes. It took a while to adjust. But I, when I got discharged, got home, I started working the next week. I didn't take any time off, or, you know, to kick back or anything. I went to work, and I think that helped me a lot to adjust.
A lot of time has passed. 65 years since World War II ended. When you look back now, and I know you work at the Veterans Memorial Museum as a volunteer docent, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, and you've been doing that for about the last 5 years. That gives you the opportunity to come in contact with a lot of young people who come through, a lot of people who have questions about World War II. What's the number one message that you try to get through to them as far as what the significance of World War II is in today's world? Why is it important for you to keep that history alive? What's important for us to remember today?
I think World War II history is very important for people to learn or to know more about, especially school kids, because I guess they're not taught about World Wars.
What do you get out of volunteering at the museum? Why did you decide to do that?
This is a great place to work. My son got me involved in the museum. He works over on just a couple of streets over from the museum, and he used to come in here on his lunch hour all the time, and he was telling me about it. He says, Dad, he says, you ought to go down there and volunteer. He says, it's a great place to work and to see and to visit. And so I said, okay, I'll visit it one of these days. And so he brought me in. So a couple of days later, I made an appointment with Art and signed up. Went to work the next week.
Well, David, thank you very much for serving our country and for telling us a little bit about it.
Well, thank you for the interview.
Well, the pleasure, as always, has been all mine. It is such a privilege to do this show, and I'm excited about doing it live from the KMJ Lifestyle Expo next Saturday at the Radisson Conference Center, so I hope that I'll see you there. Remember to get there early. 9:30 is my Preserving Family History seminar, 10:45 a seminar on Becoming an Author, and then Hometown Heroes live at 1 o'clock next Saturday from that Lifestyle Expo. If you would like to see a picture of today's guest, David Fusinato, see how young he looks for 84 going on 85, and what a great smile he has. There's a picture of him standing in his beloved Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, where he volunteers a couple days a week as a docent. There's also more information about the museum and a link where you can email me with the name of a veteran you think that I ought to talk to on this program. That is Hometown Heroes for today. Thanks so much for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.